Good morning. First, I would like to thank Antonio for inviting me to this nice place and to this conference. I'm going to tell you this morning about our work on SCM, work on graphite, and just a little bit about our results on SNS junction, N being the graphite, the graphene. My collaborators on this are Guohong Li, who built the STM and did the STM experiments, and Xu Du, Ivan Skachko, and Jorge Sanchez, who did the SNS work. And I would like to acknowledge discussion with Antonio, Pierce Coleman, and Seamus Davis. Okay, so I'm going to start. My main talk will be on the STM work. So the main results are that we did STM on graphite, and to our surprise, we saw, and in high magnetic fields, and to our surprise, we saw square root dependence on B, Landau levels with square root dependence on B and N, as well as interpenetrating a series with linear dependence on B and with square root N, N plus 1, a Landau level dependence. So this is the main result. And the surprise for us was that it's actually possible to see these things on graphite, on bulk graphite. I'm going to just briefly tell you about our SNS junction work. This is still work in progress. The main result is that we do see multiple Andreev reflections and no Josephson current. They do not go superconducting. And when we get to close to the Dirac point, we lose everything. There's no Andreev reflections. There's no trace of a gap opening up. So close to the Dirac point, everything disappears.
So is it also bulk or it's...
It is a single layer. In the single layer, it disappears. Not in, if we have more than one layer, it doesn't. Okay, so these are the various carbon allotropes, and at this conference, we of course are all excited about the 2D version. And why are we excited about it? One of the main things that is quoted is the fact that the dispersion relation of the electrons behaves as a massless Dirac fermion. We have these Dirac cones, and there's zero band mass, electron hole symmetry, pair creation. These electrons are chiral. There's a Berry phase pi, and there's all sorts of exciting things that one can do with these kinds of electrons. But we should remember that this kind of the cones are not unique to graphene. Many materials have cones, conical dispersions in their electron structure. All the dicalcogenides have cones. Graphite has two. What is special about the about graphene, this is the only place that the electrons can move. It's at these Dirac points when you put your Fermi energy here. So we don't have a Fermi surface. Basically, it's an insulator, and all the transport properties are dominated by these Dirac points. So this is what is so special about it, because that allows us to see effects of this point on the Fermi surface point, even in experiments like transport or specific heat, etc. Whereas in other materials, you just don't see them. They're just their weight is too small. So we're all excited because finally we can see this new behavior of electrons that is due to the Dirac cones, and of course. There are all sorts of devices that one can build based on these ideas. There is a strong field effect because these are so thin metallic layers, and because of the linear density of states and presence of the Dirac point. So one can hope to be able to make a metallic field effect transistor. The electrons in graphene have intrinsically long mean free paths that will lead to high conductivity, and no matter...
Necessarily, conductivity is proportional to the density of states also.
Right, but we know that they're protected at the Dirac point, so because of the chirality, you reduce the backscattering, in theory at least, they should have high conductivity. And when you make them very small, that should remain, as opposed to in the case of semiconductors, when you make the device smaller than the distance between the dopants, then you get a pure insulator. So at least this is the hope. And as we have seen at this conference, this is not necessarily the case, and as we've seen in our experiments.
The Dirac point, even the most optimistic theorists would speak about minimum metallic conductivity.
Right, absolutely. But you can just with a little bit of voltage, you can get away from it and take advantage of all the beautiful properties of the electrons there. So yeah, and if you want to make a device, you definitely don't want to sit at a Dirac point, I agree. They're naturally inert, so you can make these giant molecules and that are remarkably stable. So this is the hope for in terms of the applications, and of course it helps us get funding. Now, what happens in a magnetic field? You get Landau levels. So we go from, in a standard two-dimensional electron system, you get a gap at this node here. You'd get a gap, and you have evenly spaced Landau levels that are inversely proportional to the mass of the electrons. When you get to these cones, because of the linear dispersion, you immediately go into a square root dependence of the Landau level energy, and it's square root in both energy and Landau level index. It is also linear in the Fermi velocity. And then if you have a bilayer graphene, something very interesting happens. You go back to, density of state acquires a parabolic shape here. The energy acquires a parabolic shape, so you acquire a band mass. And the Landau level energy spacing now is linear in omega c with the corresponding band mass. But what is remarkable, as is the case for the cones as well, is that you do not have a gap at the point here, at the point where they touch. You do have a Landau level at zero energy. So this is a consequence of the chirality of these electrons. So in these two systems, even if you cannot measure directly the energy levels, as is the case in a quantum Hall effect, when you see you see the absence of a plateau at zero energy, you know that there is chirality there, that they have these properties. So here is the integer quantum Hall effect, and there was this beautiful experiment done by the Manchester group and by the Kim group. So this is what it looks like for a standard two-dimensional electron system, for a standard two-dimensional metal. And every time you fill one of these Landau levels, it will contribute a quantum of conductance E squared over H times the degeneracy to the conductance here. So every time a Landau level is filled, you get a step in the Hall conductivity. However, and this is something that people don't usually are aware of, is that Landau levels happen whenever the electron density is commensurate with the flux line in the system. So whenever n density of electrons over density of flux line becomes commensurate, you jump to another level. Now, what I would like to point out here is that even though the quantum Hall effect is due to the presence of Landau levels, it does not measure directly the Landau level energy. It only measures the commensuration of the flux lines and the density of electrons. So when we do a quantum Hall effect, whether the dispersion is linear in E or square root or anything else, the Landau levels will always be at the same place. The only thing that will be special is that you will either have or not have a jump at zero energy. So when the electrons are chiral, you're going to have an extra jump here at zero energy, as was beautifully shown by these two groups. So, for example, in graphene, you see a quantum Hall effect, but it is shifted by a half. Or in other words, you see the jump here corresponding to the presence of the Landau level at zero energy. However, I would like to emphasize again, even though there is a square root dependence of the energy on magnetic field, this is not seen at all in the Landau level. So if you do want to look at the Landau levels, you need something, a more direct probe, such as STM or some optics probes, etc. Okay, so now I'm going to go to the part, to our experiment. I'm going to tell you about our STM experiments. And so this is what an STM looks like. You have a sharp tip, and you tunnel, and you apply a voltage between your substrate and the tip, and you get some tunneling current. You have a piezoelectric tube that allows you to vary the distance between the tip and the substrate. And the current that you get here is exponentially sensitive to the distance between the tip and your substrate, so it can measure the corrugation of your substrate. And it is proportional to the density of states of your sample at the Fermi energy and at the surface of the sample. And of course, we can bias the voltage. We can bias the voltage difference between the sample and the tip, and so we can explore the density of states. So the current is proportional to density of state, and it's exponential in distance from the tip. And as a result, one can do two kinds of measurements. One is a measurement where you keep the current constant, so wherever you go on your sample, you adjust the height or the distance between the tip and the sample so that the current stays constant. And then you look at how much feedback you have to take from your motor, and then you feed that into your computer, and you can see a picture of the surface of your sample. The other mode is a spectroscopy mode, where you keep the distance constant and you measure the tunneling current. And that will depend on the density of states. And here, for example, is a measurement, a typical measurement, where you measure the differential conductivity as a function of bias voltage, and you can, for example, image the gap in a superconductor. And you can go in various places on your sample and look at what that gap looks like. So it gives you a measure of a local density of state.
Which material is that?
This is niobium disulfide. So I just want to show you here that you can do with STM, you can do spectroscopy of both occupied and unoccupied levels by biasing, putting either a positive bias between the tip and the sample or negative bias. You can either probe the empty states or the occupied states. So this is a nice feature of this technique. You can go on both sides of the Fermi energy. Now, we have built our own STM. It goes down to low temperatures and very high fields, 15 Tesla. I think at this point, we're probably the only ones who can have such high field at the same time as STM. It took us a few years to build it. This is Guo Hong Li, who did all the work. This is a huge sapphire crystal that helps us. That is our piezo motor, on which the piezo motor slide. This was the design, initial design. These are the coarse motors, and this is what it looks like viewed from head on, and this is what it looks now, the finished result in the control room. So Guo Hong in the control room looking at some data, which I'm going to show you in a moment. So here are some experiments that we did with this STM. We looked at charge density waves in niobium diselenide. Now, even though this is a very important thing to realize, there's no K vector resolution with STM. You only have real space resolution. However, because you can scan large areas, you can average over large areas, you can take the Fourier transform and effectively get K vector resolution as well. So this is, and you can definitely see this beautiful structure for the niobium selenite in K-space. This is a vortex lattice, again in niobium selenite. These are vortices here, and this is the gap in niobium selenite as it disappears with increasing field. So the gap fills in, and the coherence peaks disappear as you increase the field, so it's gone here by about 2 tesla. And this is what the topography measurement on graphite looks, HOPG graphite. We only see one of the sublattices at a given energy. And this is what I'm going to talk about today, what happens to the spectroscopy when you apply a field. All these experiments, many of these experiments were done to calibrate our STM. This one in particular, this is the standard thing to do. When you have a new STM, in order to calibrate it, you look at the surface of HOPG graphite, and you want to make sure that your distances are right where they're supposed to be. You have to calibrate your piezos. So then we wanted to see if our magnet works. So we applied magnetic field, and lo and behold, we started seeing these levels, which are not what you expect to see on graphite. Yes.
Question: is there a simple argument where you only see one sublattice?
They are different energies. The simple argument is if it is Bernel, some of the atoms in the bottom layer have one on top and the others don't, and that gives you a little bit of splitting in energy. So you have to dial your energy to a different.
So you would expect that when you go to graphene, you have to see.
Exactly. This is precisely it. So if you have a graphene layer, you would see a honeycomb lattice. That's right, yes. Okay, so this is the spectrum. So here we sweep the sample bias from negative to positive. So on this side here we see the occupied states. On this side here we see empty states. Half a tesla, 2 tesla, there are these little peaks developing, 3 tesla. And they look like very nice big features. And they're not noise because we can actually follow them in field, this little star here. They actually evolve. They move out to higher energy as you increase the field. Now, this was a beautiful sample. And when we cranked up the field a little more, the tip crashed. So we had to change samples. And these are the sorts of hazards of being an experimentalist. So the rest of the data will be on a different sample. Okay, I also must say something about the sample itself. This is highly oriented paralytic graphite. And there are many grades of paralytic graphite according to what's called the mosaicity, how big the single crystals are and how they're oriented with respect to each other. So the smaller the dispersion in angle of these crystals, the more expensive they are. So we have there are 3 grades that you can buy commercially. We have an $80 crystal, we have an $800 crystal, and a $5,000 crystal. The $5,000 crystal is used for analyzers in X-ray machines, very sharp peaks. Now, maybe this is something to do with what we're seeing. This kind of beautiful data we've only been able to see on the $80 sample. Okay. They are masked by other things. They're not there in Kish graphite, which is natural graphite, which is much stronger coupled in the C direction. Okay, so this is a sequence going up to 12 tesla of these peaks. And I just, as a guide to them, first, there's 2 types of peaks here. It's difficult to see, but I'm going to guide you through it. There's the purple sequence, which I've plotted here. I've plotted only one of these peaks on both sides of zero. So this is the sequence. And notice the scale here. It goes like b, the square root of b. So when we plot it against square root of b, we get them to align. Now, another thing that I want you to notice is this, what I call the A peak here, is totally inert. It completely doesn't move with field. It just stays fixed. And then there is another peak here, which we call Z, that I'm going to discuss later. So there's two things to notice about the data. One is that the square dependence, which is pretty good in B. Secondly, when you extrapolate to zero field, of course, we don't see these things at very low fields. When you extrapolate to zero field, it goes. Both branches go to one point, and that point coincide with what I call the A peak. Now, this dispersion look exactly like what you would expect of the dispersion of electrons that sit on a Dirac cone. And with this being the Dirac cone, notice there's a slight shift from zero. Now, let's go over to the green sequence here. Now, the green sequence aligns not when I plot it as a function of square root of B, but when I plot it as a function of B. And again, what is remarkable here is that when you extrapolate to zero field, it again extrapolates to the same energy as this A peak. So they all, at zero field, they all collapse to one energy. So there is an offset of about 20 millivolts here, which means that the Dirac point is 20 millivolts above the Fermi energy. So what we're going to do next is subtract it out and measure everything with respect to that point, to this point here. So we're going to just have a shift in the energy. So now, so the next thing that one has to verify is this sequence also square root in Landau level index, not only in field, because that's what you'd expect for Dirac fermions. So what we did here is now we plot. So now we number these peaks. I'm going to start with the square root sequence. So we number the ones on the right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the ones on the left with negative integers. And we put the Landau level index on the x-axis and energy over square root of B on the y-axis. And you see it looks like this. It doesn't look like a straight line, but as soon as we scale this to square root of the index, they all align on a single line. So it looks like they both have a square root dependence on field and on Landau level index. So this is pretty suggestive that what we're seeing here is a sequence that is due to Dirac fermions. Now let's go to the, and we can also get, now that's another important reference point. The slope will give us the Fermi velocity, and it is pretty much consistent with the Fermi velocity measured with transport experiments. So that gives us confidence that this analysis is reasonable. So let me now move to the linear sequence. Now in the linear sequence, so it's linear in B. Now there's two choices that we can have, of course, many others. If it's a standard two-dimensional electrons in a metal, then it should be not only linear in B but linear in J, and it should have a gap at the Fermi point, at the Dirac point. So we would expect something like this. On the other hand, if it is a two-layer graphene, if the sequence is due to a two-layer graphene, a bilayer, which would give us massive chiral particles, so a little bit of a rounding off here, a parabolic band mass, developing a parabolic band mass here, which is proportional to the coupling between the layers. And that will give us a cyclotron frequency EB over M star C, this M star here. And the sequence should be linear in B. It should have a Landau level at zero energy. And it should not be linear in the Landau level numbers. The dependence on Landau level numbers is only linear at high Landau levels, but at low Landau levels, it's square root of J times J plus 1. So we went to the data and checked for that. So now we plot, so now the linear sequence is numbered here, the ones that align on a linear, so the way we identify them, we plot the DIDV, the differential conductance. By the way, these are all shifted in energy to make it easier to see. So the linear sequence aligns nicely on lines when we plot the data against E over B, whereas the square root sequence aligns nicely when we plot the data against E over B to the 1/2. So this is how we identify them. Otherwise, it would be hard to do. So this is our linear sequence here numbered, and we plot the energy E over B against Landau level index, and we see that it doesn't work. So then we plot it against a J times a J plus 1 square root, and lo and behold, they do align. So it looks like they do follow that dependence. Also, we can extract from this data, since we have omega C here is in a prefactor, we can extract the effective mass, and what we get is something 0.03 electronic masses, which is quite comparable to what people see in transport. It is, however, almost a factor of 2 smaller than what people see with ARPES on graphite.
I thought you were looking at both
records. That's right. We thought that too. Yes. That's a very good question. Right. So what's going on here? I mean, we're not supposed to see any of this stuff. The main thing is that we don't have any K vector resolution. When we shoot the electrons in, they go into any levels that are available. So one shouldn't see this. Yes.
What was the position of the tip in this particular measurement?
It is vertical.
About which angle?
Oh, sorry. Thank you for asking this. Of course. This is an average. We average over quite a large area. But it depends on which particular data, but a few hundred nanometers. So lots of atoms. It's not a single atom.
Is it implicit, this averaging, is it implicit or you do it deliberately?
No, we just do it because there's too much noise to just take one spectrum. And we do it over large areas because we don't want to be sensitive to each atom individually.
But it would be interesting to know what would be the spectroscopic difference.
To sit on a particular sublattice.
Well, if you are either above AM or you're or you're between A and B.
We can do that and take average just sitting in one place, and we haven't done that. But that could be interesting. Yes.
With that resolution, we can get more information and really start comparing with our data.
Can you do, at least in principle, Fourier transform STM in the field?
Yes.
Get momentum?
Yes, we have done a little bit of that. It can be done in principle. It's a matter of how long you can sit in the same place with things not moving, so that your averaging is meaningful. And we are getting there. We have done that with the niobium diselenide. You've seen we were able to get very nice K space.
Maybe you already mentioned it, but
just say, okay.
Your first square root of B level is somewhere higher than. I mean, can you show us again what's the energy of the square root of B? It's like
here?
40 something, right? So
yeah, it is higher, yes.
So
it is the linear sequence is sitting inside here, yes.
Do you see these linear UV levels above this?
Yes, I'll show you all of them together, so you see how it
higher,
looks.
Higher
we do see them interspersed, yes, right.
But in this plot, the lower energy peaks are linear sequences.
Yes, so this is, but you don't see it because this is plotted against E over square root of B. When I plot it against E over B, you see them line up nicely, and the other ones get messed up.
But in your square root, linear in B plot, you also see this, right?
Yeah, but it doesn't align, right? So here, You see, now they're the linear ones, and the other guys are not aligned.
Yeah, I think it's sort of reasonable to think you're seeing just the first couple of layers. Have you done? Maybe you mentioned it already.
No, I haven't. I'm getting there. No.
That's something that you've done or can do. Presumably, will give you some information about, if you're actually going into the second layer, that will affect you.
Why should it affect? Why could it allow me to distinguish between 3D and 2D?
Graphite is three-dimensional.
Right.
Metal, semi-metal, is two pieces of semi-surface, which both are compact. The word compact means what?
Right. Yeah, I decided not to show that because it was in every talk at this conference.
I mean, at a different level, you can, once, if they're going in a layer, they're not sensitive to the flux. That's perfect. That's parallel.
Right.
Once they're actually tunneling.
Oh, I see what you mean. I see what you mean. So I'm going to see some contribution.
Talk about this.
Right. Right. Now, as I'm sure you're going to show you in a moment, we are probably not seeing anything in between layers because I'm going to get there. But when you do really three-dimensional graphite, I mean, this is when we go to the fancier sample, we see nothing like this, and it is really three-dimensional.
Generally, that's a test of how. Whether you're really seeing 2D data, things just depend on the
right.
Corner of the field.
Right, exactly. So then, exactly, yes. No, we haven't done that, but there's another reason we're pretty sure it's two-dimensional behavior, which I'm getting to now, looking just at the Brillouin zone of graphite, of the three-dimensional case, looking just at the band structure, what you would expect if you see 3D behavior.
You showed pictures of the topography of the surface of graphite. Is it consistently AB stacking over these large distances of which you were averaging?
This is a very good point. Now, the beautiful picture that I showed you was of the fancy graphite. When we do pictures of this graphite, it doesn't look anything as pretty. So you
probably don't have AB stacking over large distances.
That might be it. We even see moiré patterns. We haven't done this systematically. Because, pips crash and all sorts of things happen, I mean, this is the many, many days and weeks of work went into getting a sequence like this because there's always something that happened. So, we leave taking the actual topography for the end, when we finish the whole run, and if something happens in video, we haven't done it on the same sample. So at this point, we don't have the systematics. These experiments are extremely challenging. What?
This data, is it taken from the same sample?
Yes. This is all on one. So we managed to get a sequence on one sample up to 12 Tesla. That's when we had an accident. Okay. I'm going to... let me show you in a moment what I think is going on. And, of course, tilting the field would be a very nice thing to do. We're already pretty satisfied to have a field in there, period. Tilting it is another story. We can tilt the field in our dilution refrigerator, but we don't have an STM there. So, so this is, you asked me about this question. So here are all the sequences. So this is our square root sequence. So all the peaks are plotted here. So we have the square root sequence. We have the linear sequence. So you see, if you take there are places where they do intersect, where they do go through each other. And then there is a sequence that is unidentified, neither square root nor linear, and that sequence may have something to do with the bulk, with something in the z direction. So this is our what I call the z peak, and there are others. And you see these guys, there's a series here that does not meet at the same point. It looks like there's a gap here, and that's a good candidate for the LM direction. I'm going to show you the band structure in a moment. Okay, so this is what the data looks like in summary, yes?
Yeah,
you know if you have electrons or holes?
Well, it depends on what side. We have both, right? Let me hear. So here you're on the. So this is the. This is.
But I was sort of thinking of the looking at the four old sheets.
So this is, yeah, this is our Dirac point here. So here you're on one side of the Dirac point and here you're on the other. So the thing is the following. We are, in one case, the electrons out of the tip tunnel into available states, empty states above the Dirac point. In the other case, when the sample is biased negatively, we have electrons out of existing states or fill levels tunneling into the tip. So we see both kind levels. However, these are single electrons. So, and this is a very interesting question. If you're looking for a fractional quantum Hall effect, first of all, I wouldn't know at all where to look at it. With quantum Hall effect, it's pretty straightforward. You just look at the fraction of the filling factor. With energy spectroscopy, you have no idea where to look except that it's going to be somewhere here. But more, and this is more crucially, if I'm tunneling into empty states, just single electrons, how do they know to interact to form a composite particle? And on the other hand, when I tunnel out of my existing levels, let's say that I do have a composite particle, what am I going to see? It has to first break up into electrons. So perhaps if one were to see the fractional quantum Hall effect, I would certainly not expect it on the whole, on the empty level side. I would perhaps expect it on the fill level side. Okay, so let's now, I mean, this was tremendously puzzling to us, yes?
The massive fermions, they're only one sequence, so you can fit all those lines with a single effective mass?
A single effective mass, all of them. Okay, so we were really scratching our heads of what's going on here, why do we see this? So we're going back to look at graphite, at the band structure of graphite, and this is what it looks like. Now, there is the K point where you do have a parabolic dispersion and the point where they touch. So this is the point here. Then there is the H point where you have a nice Dirac cone, and this is the point here. But there are other things going on. And for example, in the KH direction up here, you have energy levels at zero energy. So you have a whole band here. And this band, when you do any kind of experiments, including tunneling, it should dominate everything because it has a huge weight. So it looks like we are not seeing this. And this is a band with a small, this is a small gap, and I think those two sequences that don't converge to zero energy must be due to here, at least the energy fits. So for some reason, it looks like we only see these two points when we do our SDM in this particular type of sample. So in first of all, I want to remind you that the point where the bands meet in the H and K points, the Dirac cone and the quadratic dispersion, are shifted in graphite by a few tenths of millielectron volts. In our case, both sequences converge to exactly the same energy, and I think that is significant. In the LM direction here, I already said that there is a small gap. KH gives us a continuous band. So if we did tunnel into this band, everything would be wiped out because it dominates. It would dominate the spectra. It would give huge line, huge intensities. So apparently we don't see this. And thanks to Dimitri for sending me this.
I haven't made this diagram.
I know. That's why. But you didn't send me any reference. It's from his talk. Okay. So these are the... Okay, and this is again from Dimitri. Now, so along the KH direction, this is this thing here. This is what the band structure looks like. And so the spectrum should be dominated, and this is in zero field, should be dominated by these, by the K point. If we saw a bulk graphite. Now, there is beautiful work by the Japanese group that did see Landau levels on graphite, and they did do it on the expensive graphite. And this is what this is a calculation of the evolution of the Landau levels with field, 2 tesla, 6 tesla, and here they have the STM data, and you know, you get these bands. The sequences cannot be classified as square root or linear or anything. It's quite complicated, and it fits very nicely the 3D calculation in those samples. So here we see precisely what I was saying, that the spectrum is dominated by the KH state. Now let me say a few words about ARPES, comparing our data to ARPES. So there is a beautiful piece of experimental work done by the Lanzara group, where they also looked at graphite. Now in graphite, in with ARPES, it doesn't matter whether you have the 3D bands or not. You can have very precise K vector resolution. So if there is a cone, you're going to find it. You're not going to be distracted by all the other levels. And indeed, that's what they saw. So here at the H point, they saw this beautiful linear dispersion. Then they did the ARPES data near the K point. And then they saw parabola. I just want to mention here that the tip of this dispersion here in their data, when they zoom in, is offset by 50 millivolts below the Dirac point. So actually, the Fermi energy in their data sits about here, 50 millivolts below the Dirac point. Now, when they do, when they go to the H point, they see this parabola, and the Fermi energy is again offset by. So this is the H point. The H point linear dispersion, zooming in. So here you see right away this 50 millivolt offset. So now we're going to the H point. The H point has a parabola here. It actually touches the Dirac point, so there's no offset. So you see there is a shift, energy shift, between those points, between the K and H points in graphite, as expected from theory. So clearly this is bulk behavior. Now, this graphite was, I believe it was the expensive one, the Kish graphite. And I think it was a natural, and the Kish graphite is known, this is natural graphite. The HOPG is synthesized. And I think I heard that, she didn't tell this to me personally, but I heard it from, I think, somebody, that it is, the way to get Kish graphite, you go to your geologist friends. And they have these beautiful crystals sitting there, which come from mines. You cannot buy this, and they're very, very good crystals. So I think she got a piece of that. I mean, there is cheap, there's medium, expensive, and there's you cannot buy. Okay, so comparing the STM data with the ARPES. So ARPES sees a 50 millivolt offset of the at the H point and no offset at the K point, linear and the parabolic dispersion here. We see the exact same offset at both points. So that's another indication that we are looking at something two-dimensional. Because in two-dimensional case, the H and K point are have the same energy. There's no H point. There's just K points and graphene and bilayer graphene, they would be at the same point. So this is one hint, and the fact that we don't see all the other, we're not blocked by the KZ states, indicates that we are probably looking at 2D graphene and double layers of graphene. Now the why that is, you don't agree? Why that is, we don't know. Now, one, there is something that may be important here. We can make these sequences go away. The only way we see these sequences if the tip is really far, if we have very low currents. When we bring the tip into the surface, we destroy these sequences and we start seeing three-dimensional behavior. So it looks like, and we actually did a topographic measurement of what the surface looks like as a function of distance, and when we bring the tip close, it sort of buckles. So it looks like we are increasing the interlayer interactions when we bring it close. Now, the question is, why is it that in this graphite we see this kind of behavior? Now, it is not that we have a flake sitting there and because it wouldn't be stable. So these experiments are reproducible. We can go up in temperature and in field. And yes, do you have a question?
Does it buckle up?
It buckles down when you press it.
It just goes underneath.
Right.
And how far can you go without breaking tip?
We don't actually touch. We just come close. The moment you touch, it's done. The experiment is over. I'm not sure about the numbers. Something like an angstrom or so, but I'm not sure. I have to check that. It's significant. It's not negligible.
So the big experiment on this expensive graphite, you see only linear?
We don't see any of this. We just see the bulk behavior in the expensive graphite.
That's like linear in field, right?
No, it's not linear in field. It's the whole sequence that I showed you that you integrate over the entire KH direction. And most of the contribution come from H. But it looks like things like this, like the Japanese group saw.
I remember the claim that the nanolevel changes linear in this field. It's a field.
Well, it changes, you know, like this. It's not quite linear, but... But we see things that are consistent with their data. It's we have some that are linear, some that are not. Just like what I showed you, the bulk sequence, there was one that was linear but was not converging to zero. It was gap, but there was another one that was kind of like this.
Is there any struggle with the behavior
in energy? It's pretty hard to get to extract. We haven't really analyze them very carefully. In principle, there should be because the cones are there, but there's so much other stuff going on that it would be hard to find, and it could be just obscured.
When you're so far on the surface, are you able to see atomic resolution?
No. No, we have to really come in much closer. That's one of the things that we are worried about, because if we do that, we might sort of scratch the sample if we go too close.
So if you do measurement, when you see these two sequences, you are at a distance where you're not able to see resolution.
Right. Okay. So now we really don't know what is going on. Just saying that you have very weak coupled graphite is not good enough, like the turbostratic graphite, because why would you see two sequences? If you're able to see the spectrum from a bilayer, then that means that you're not very poorly coupled. So that doesn't make sense. But I kind of like the suggestion that Borodia made, that perhaps we have an exfoliated surface and the layers are really fluffed up at the surface, and then you have regions where you have a bilayer and region where you have a single layer, and since we're going over a large area, we are averaging. a few hundred nanometers by square.
But then you would struggle to see bulk behavior.
You would what?
You would struggle to see bulk behavior.
But the bulk behavior is quite weak here. Yes. So how can you tell if that is the scenario? So you have to go in. You have to bring your tip in. If it's graphene, you're going to see nice honeycomb structure. If it is a bilayer, you're going to see the triangular lattice. So this is a nice way to confirm this. At this point, we're not settled to till the field. But would that help in this case? I mean, we already have... I mean, if it is not a single-layer bilayer, how can you explain that we don't have the... all the spectra that have to do with the z direction.
Do you see different things in the metals, usual metals that have very good surfaces? Because this layer is probably the surface in fact. So what?
Like what?
Like seeing different things in STM than in other measurements that cross the bar.
You mean things like the Landau? I can't think of. I'm sure there are. I know there are. It just doesn't come to me right now. So maybe if I remember, I'm going to tell you. No, I'm sure there are. There are things, yes. I mean, because with STM, you're really probing a surface property. So there are all sorts of modes at the surface that are not in the bulk. You'd see those. Any kind of levels that are localized at the surface will be visible with STM. In fact, whenever you do STM, you have no idea what's happening in the bulk. It's only, you know, a projection of what's happening in the bulk. It's a true surface probe, as is ARPIS. So we only conjecture that from the surface properties what happens in the bulk. So, yeah, there are lots of examples, yes.
Could you do X-ray in the surface to see what's going on?
You mean like going at some sort of a grazing angle? But you have some... Well, X-ray is really a penetrating probe. Can one just see the surface? It
penetrates too much.
Yeah, it's too penetrating, yeah. But I think our STM is the best probe there is. Just bring it in and looking at the atom structure may be the way to go. So after we've taken all the data we want, we just go in and don't care about ruining it.
Is it possible that you might get lucky and do an averaging over smaller regions and only one of these features would show up?
That is definitely a possibility. So, you know, there's so many things that we haven't tried yet, but... you know, I think with these ideas, maybe we can take this a little further.
Is the offset always the same, or is it sample dependent?
It's sample dependent. It changes. But it's of the same order of magnitude. It's different every time. So the offset presumably comes from some charging. If you have some, you know... And there's always some charging in every experiment. And when people look at real graphene, it's much more dramatic, as I'm going to show you in a moment, if I have time. If not, okay. So, right, if not, if you want to see the SNS work, we can talk about it later. So I'm just going to quickly go through it. So the SNS junk, the bottom line is that we see multiple Andreev reflection. No Josephson current, everything goes away at the Dirac point. I think that's the message.
I have one more question. When you were fitting the peaks which had the linear dependence and pulled out the effective mass, I guess they've done these measurements on just bilayer tracking where they all zero energy state. Can you get some...
I mean, we get very similar numbers that to within 30% or so. Yeah, very similar, but they're different from the ARPIS numbers, which is also not surprising.
But they're
from the ARPIS graphite numbers.
What about the
zero field. At zero field, is it a superposition of a linear?
It is mostly linear. I'm going to show it to you later. It is mostly linear. Okay. So this is a little different, switching gears. So here we really tried to look at graphene. So we made a sample. So silicon oxide, this is either graphene or few layer graphene, and we deposited electrodes. We've done both niobium and aluminum with a thin titanium sticking layer. Oops. Okay, so this is what it looks like. Then you go to an AFM, you pick your spot where it looks promising, and here we have a step that corresponds to a monolayer, and we zoom into that. We go to the e-beam lithography, and this is two pieces of graphene, and we put electrodes here. It's a two-lead measurement. This is a very small gap here. It's about 300, 400 nanometers, and we just do transport. What's this proximity? I mean, you can probably induce in most materials, insulator, you can induce superconductivity. You have a superconductor here and superconductor here. You have a normal area here. Whether or not you can induce a Josephson current depends on the relative, on whether your sample is shorter from the relevant decoherence and phase decoherence and coherence length. So in our samples, the coherence lengths of the order 100 nanometers or more. So if we make a short enough junction, there is hope that we can have coherent transport across the normal junction. So what's an Andreev reflection? You have an electron that is trying to come in from the normal side. It penetrates in the superconductor. It needs a pair, so then there's a hole coming back. Now, the bottom line is that what does this look like in your resistance? So when you do an IV characteristic at zero temperature, you'd see something like this. So your resistance has dropped to half what it was before, basically because the current has doubled. And you, as you increase the temperature, you smear this effect out and you fill in this gap here. So this is what an SN junction looks. When you have an SNS junction, so the electron is trying to come in here. It sheds and it injects another electron here to make a pair in the superconductor, but it's too small to go here. So then there's a hole that is reflected, and every time it picks up V in the electric field, the hole, so they each pick up the same V. So and eventually, when it's gone enough times here, it can just go through. So that is what the Andreev reflection is. So what you expect, you're going to have a subharmonic gap structure that is 2 delta over some integer times E. Okay, so here is our graphene device, 260 millikelv. We see the gating effect. The resistance goes up here, and at minus 40 volts, which is the self-charging, you see that the Dirac point, the resistance goes up to about 5 kilo ohms. Now, in this region here, we have noise, but this noise is not noise really because it's reproducible. So it's the same thing, 2K, 260 millik, it becomes irreproducible at higher temperatures. Signatures of weak localization or... On this side here, we're in the metallic region. Here and here is the Dirac point. Now, subharmonic gap structure, so we do DVDI as a function of bias. Here we sit not at the Dirac point, and we see these peak structure at 2 delta, at delta, And this is a 3D picture of the intensity, is the height, is the intensity of the signal, gate voltage versus bias, and you see this is at zero here, zero bias, so this is a delta, 2 delta over 3, so it looks like we do have some sub-gap structure here. So this looks... What?
Where is your density on this one? The horizontal line is...
I'm sitting way on the metallic side. Way on the metallic side. On the N side. So this is a positive bias here. Okay, so this is what it looks like for... this is about 7 layers junction. And this is what it looks like for a graphene junction. Look at these diamonds here. These are typical of universal conduction fluctuation. So what's the temperature dependence? So this is the resistance at 9K here above the superconducting transition. We don't see anything. And then we drop the temperature, 7 Kelvin 6K, 260 milliK. So you see this Andrea reflection. Now, what is remarkable that at zero bias, at the lowest temperature, this dip here is inverted. It actually goes up. We don't know what that is due to. Now I'm going few-layer graphene at 4.2K, 7 layers, looks like this. I'm doing the same thing with the single-layer graphene. It looks like this. I don't see any trace of a gap. And I go to 200 milliK, it sort of looks like it wants to diverge. This is not gate voltage, this is bias. This is at fixed gate. And this is what it looks like, this is what the graphene looks like. In the same plot, we have, this is the Dirac point here. This is the Dirac point here. Okay, that's it, I'm done? Okay. So basically, this is the message that there is no gap when you get to the Dirac point or zero bias here. This is close to the Dirac point. This just all these features, this induced superconductivity is gone. And comparing that with the same junction here in the metallic region, you do see. So when you go to the close to Dirac point, all these features disappear, and we get a peak instead of a dip in the resistance. And I'm going to leave you with this question. Why don't we see a supercurrent? Why is it so difficult to see supercurrent? It's not that it's impossible. One group has seen it, but three groups have not. And apparently there is something that's very difficult. There is something that's going on there that needs to be understood. In most junctions like this, it's pretty easy to induce the supercurrent, to induce superconductivity. With the graphene, there's something going on which decoheres the Cooper pairs much earlier than one would think when you're in graphene. And it's possible it has to do with the corrugation of the surface.
Is this group that have observed it?
Yes, there is a group.
About anything. They didn't write about any difficulties.
Yeah, but there's three groups that didn't. So there is something that they're doing that they're either not telling us or that they're not aware of, that the rest of us are not doing.
What is the contact used? What is the material?
We did both, two types of junctions. One is niobium on graphene, and the other is identical and totally independent. We didn't know about their work. Aluminum was a titanium binding layer. And that is the same as the Delft group did, but we didn't see it.
It's the same kind.
It's
the same alloy, right?
It's the same alloy, yes. Okay, and here I'm going to leave the summary up. Thank you for your attention.
I think we have quite excess the time for the questions, so I'll take two, okay?
I mean, first, as I was reporting in the early days of STM experiments, that's on graphite, that sometimes the top layer got stuck to the tip.
and then it came unstuck from the bottom layer, so they were actually pulling it out of the other layers, and then it would become decoupled. And, you know, it seems it happens often in the early things.
Well, it happens to us a lot. When that happens, the run is dead. We don't see anything. So, you know, you lose your resolution, you lose everything. No. If it happened, we couldn't do any of this stuff. Because when you drag the thing along, everything looks the same, right? And
the second thing, when you do spectroscopy, it's true that at low energy you only see one sublattice, but if you go to high energy as compared to the interlayer, you will see the second sublattice.
Right. But that's about 3 volts, isn't it?
No, 0.3
volts. 0.3 volts. We've never gone to such high energy, but that is a good, interesting point. Yes.
One more technical question. In principle, is it possible to do STM on graphene or bilayer?
In principle, it's possible. I think we haven't tried it. There are several technical difficulties. The graphene is very small. The samples are micron size. And this is purely technical. So you have your STM here. How are you going to find it? So you have to make a map to find it. People have done that. People have even looked at carbon nanotubes. So, but it is difficult. Then secondly, you're worried about the substrate, right? The standard substrate for graphene is silicon oxide. It is well known that silicon oxide charges up. So the graphene has a random potential which is quite violent. What is it going to do? It is certainly not going to do good things, and you're not going to see it's going to mess up your substrate. In a sense, graphite, to my opinion, is the best substrate you can think of for graphene. It's perfectly lattice matched. There's no charging effect. There's no impurities. It is the ideal substrate, you know. So any other substrate, you'd have problems with charging, with defects. And then you put it down there, you would worry about exactly what Paco said, that it sticks to your tip rather than to substrate, and then you just drag it along, and then you don't see anything. So there are various, we haven't tried. You know, I mean, this was totally unintentional. We never would have dreamed that we would see these things on graphite. And perhaps if it's not going to be as difficult as one thinks it is. So, yeah.
Shall we thank Eva for this wonderful talk and meet again at 10:30?
Yeah, thank you.